Hello again and welcome to another edition of Authors Audio. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. Remember, you can listen to all of our interviews by simply visiting our website at www.authorsaudio.com. Click on the listen icon to hear any of our interviews or visit our archive section to learn more about our authors and to purchase their books. Today I have with me an amazing man, an author. He is a New Yorker. His name is Thomas E. Kennedy. He was born in New York City in 1944 under the sign of Pisces and grew up in Elmhurst and Jackson Heights. His father was president of the Long Island City Savings Bank and wrote poetry in the evenings, oddly enough. And one evening when Thomas was looking for something to read, his father gave him a copy of Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, and Kennedy had immediately caught the bug and developed an intense interest in fiction and its glimpse into the hidden world behind the reality that was his own at that time. He started reading Russian, French, Irish, British, and American authors, and a story by Catherine Mansfield, Miss Brill, so affected him at the age of 17, he decided he wanted to be an author himself. His latest book is called Riding the Dog, A Look Back at America, a series of essays about riding the greyhound through the country of his birth. And if anyone here, and most of you probably have, if you've taken a bus through the country of the United States or the country that you live in, you'll find out that that's really the only way to find out about the real people, the real look and taste and smell of the cities and towns and the countryside of which the bus is passing through. And I highly recommend this book. It's called Riding the Dog, again published by New American Press, 2008. Also, Thomas has some really great news this year, as Anton Mueller of Bloomsbury USA, a major publisher, is pleased to announce the acquisition of In the Company of Angels by Thomas E. Kennedy, one of the four books in Kennedy's Copenhagen Quartet. And although Kennedy's novels are internationally acclaimed, his work has gone mainly unnoticed by major U.S. publishers until now. So we are very, very happy to speak and have with us today Thomas E. Kennedy, all the way from Copenhagen. Thomas, it's great to have you on the program. You have been very busy as usual. You've written, I don't know, is it 24 books or something like that?
About 24 or 25, I think.
Yeah, Thomas is a really... not only an excellent writer, but he is very, very productive. Let's start a little bit from the beginning, Thomas, and just for the people that don't know you, let's talk about your early days in New York. And basically, I think it was your father that kind of introduced you to Dostoevsky. And from there, you seem to have grown more and more interested in books and eventually writing. Is that right?
That's quite right. One evening when I was 15 years old, back in my my house in Queens, New York, I was kind of, you know, the way a 15-year-old is. I was kind of restless and felt that something was missing, and you know, my father was a great reader, and so I went down to the living room, and he was sitting in his blue overstuffed armchair where he usually was reading a book. And I said to him, you know, I asked him whether he had something that would be, you know, something for me to read, you know, that he would recommend. And he thought for a moment, and he got up, and he had these beautiful wooden glass-doored bookcases. And he opened one of them, and he went and he picked down a red volume. And he handed it to me, and he said, well, why don't you try this? And I looked at it, and it was Fyodor Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, mm-hmm. which, you know, I thought was kind of weird. I was thinking, you know, what is this, a book about Russian criminology or something. But, well, you know, I respectfully thanked him and I brought it upstairs and I thought, well, you know, I could as well try and read this. And I started reading it, and within one or two pages, I was totally hooked. And it opened a whole new world for me. I read that through every spare moment I had for the next several days. I was just reading, and when I was finished with it, I went and got other books by Dostoevsky, and I read more or less everything he had written. And then I went on to other authors, not only Russian, but French and American authors. And I was, you know, it was just a complete change in my life. Then when I was 17, and I had read many, many books by then, I wish that I could still read at the same rate that I did in those days. Mm-hmm. But when I was 17, one evening I was reading a collection of short stories by Catherine Mansfield, a wonderful short story writer from New Zealand.
Right.
Who moved to Europe. I read this one very short story called Miss Brill, which was about an elderly woman who, due to the thoughtlessness of two young people, her self-image was kind of destroyed. And it is a very powerful story. And when I read it, I was kind of devastated myself, and I got angry at the author because I hadn't quite understood yet the difference between a character and a person, a human being.
Yes.
And I decided that I would write to Catherine Mansfield and sort of scold her for doing this terrible thing to this poor old defenseless woman. And I looked at the biographical note on the back of the book, and I discovered that Catherine Mansfield was in fact dead and had been dead for about 40 years. So then that sort of turned my head around, and I was thinking, God, it's as though she has reached out of the grave and touched my heart, you know, really deeply. And that was sort of the evening when I decided that I wanted to try to be a writer myself.
Wow.
And and I started writing, very fledgling stories. And my father encouraged me. He would read everything I wrote, and he was very supportive of that. He had always wanted to be a writer himself. He was a banker. But he wrote poetry, and he published a couple of poems, but not very much. But I think he was happy that I turned to it as well.
I think that's a major help psychologically for any writer, any artist at all, because it's hard enough to get the work done and get it out there and live at the same time. And it's a tough life until you get into, if you're lucky enough to get into some of the money that is there for top writers. Yeah.
Well, that's true. And it was also tough in the sense that it actually took me 20 years from that evening when I was 17. It took me 20 years to publish my first short story. I had encouragement. I had received some grants. I even had an agent when I was in my mid-20s. And a big time agent, and I had encouraging notes from editors, but somehow nothing that I wrote was getting published, and I was kind of a bit demoralized. And then finally, I left New York. I was offered a job in France when I was 30. And I took that job, and I lived in France for a couple of years, and then I moved to Copenhagen, to Denmark. And I kept trying to write without much success, without any publishing success anyway. Mm-hmm. But I guess I was learning. And then finally, one day when I was 37, I started writing this story, and a story called The Sins of Generals, which is in my short story collection, Unreal City. Mm-hmm. And when I was about five pages into the writing of that, I realized that that this story was going to be published. This was the first story, the first viable story that I had written. I felt confident of it, and sure enough, it was published. And after that, I did much better. And I think what I did was I had found my way into the place where my stories are.
Yeah, so in other words, so what a lot of people say is that you found your voice then.
Well, I guess that is true, although I don't usually use that expression because, to me, I think a writer has to have many different voices, and each story has its own voice. And, you know, there are certain writers whose voice you can identify instantly. I guess John Steinbeck, for example, like Ernest Hemingway and so on and so forth. And they did find their voice. But I think most writers will have perhaps a different voice for more or less every story or every group of stories.
Some writers that seem to almost cling to a general tone for their books, even though the stories are much different. But I find that your work is very different, and it takes twists and turns, which makes it a lot more interesting as far as a reader is concerned. And so when you got to Copenhagen, when did you get there? Did you go there in your early 20s or?
Well, I visited Copenhagen the first time to attend a conference for an international organization I was working for. And that was in 1972 when I was, 28 years old.
Yeah.
And I just fell in love with the place, and I thought, this is where I would really like to live. And it took me about 5 or 6 years to really engineer my transplantation via France to Copenhagen. But then I finally moved here in 1976 full time, and I've been here ever since.
Yes. Now it is. I often make mistakes in regards to certain things, so I'll clear this up right now. It's Copenhagen or Hagen? It's Hagen.
It's Copenhagen, yeah.
Copenhagen, yeah.
And the reason that people are confused about that, I think, is because Danny Kaye, when he sang that song, Wonderful, Wonderful, he called it Copenhagen. and that has caused a kind of terminal confusion in people. You know?
Yes. Well, these things do happen. And you have a quartet of books that have been quite popular, I believe, in Europe, and somewhat well received too in the United States. And I think they are called the Copenhagen Quartet.
That's correct.
And,
yes.
Maybe you could just name the titles of those books, because they're different books, but they come under this kind of title because you sort of separate them into spring, summer, fall, and winter.
Exactly. I've written a novel for each of the seasons in Copenhagen, and the seasons are pretty clearly demarcated here. But I also, they're independent novels, so you don't have to read all four of them. Or you don't have to read them in any particular order.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different characters in each novel, but they are sort of, I like to think of them as neighbors, different families, but they live close to each other. And I also set myself this task of writing each one in a different style, so that the first one is a kind of an experimental novel. It's a novel disguised as a guide to the serving houses of Copenhagen, the pubs. And that's the spring novel, which has the subtitle A Love Story, because it's set in spring. And then the summer novel is called Green Summer, and that's a kind of a traditional novel, and I sort of think of it as a novel with a conscience, with a social conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a Chilean torture survivor who is being treated in the torture rehabilitation center in Copenhagen, and who meets a woman who has survived a violent marriage, and it's about them trying to find each other. And then the winter novel is called Blue It's Blue Hours, and that is set in winter, which is a very dramatic season here. It's at the depth of winter, you get very little light, and what light you get is kind of gloomy, kind of dusk-like. And it's, that particular season that I set it in was a freezing winter where all the water was frozen. And because it was in winter, that was a kind of a noir novel, a kind of a novel in which violence and sex and alcohol features a large role, and loneliness and so forth. And then the last novel is called Danish Fall, and that's, of course, set in autumn. And that's about the downsizing of a Danish company. And there are 12 characters in it, and the novel is about what happens to each of these 12 characters as this company downsizes. Mm. And it's a satire.
Yeah. Yeah, I will say to my listeners that Thomas is a voluminous, for a man that really got into his writing in about when he was about 36, he has produced a real volume of literature and essays, and he's you're also in a film on Copenhagen, so it's Hagen, yeah, okay.
Hagen, yeah. It's okay. You can call it Copenhagen if you like, because some people do.
This writing career of yours has really been rewarding, especially you've worked through many books and many themes, and now you have an award from AWP, the Organization of Writers and Writing Programs. You have two Eric Hoffer Awards in 2007, and you're just about, or very near, you've signed a deal with, of all companies, the Bloomsbury Publishers, with a two-book deal for two novels in 2010-2011. For the first book, they're called In the Company of Angels.
Yes.
And that's just I want to congratulate you on that, because it looks like if everything goes the way it should, is that they also want to republish some of your other work and get it into the U.S. and that's just great news, Thomas. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy about that. I had not expected that to happen. I've been writing now publishing now for 25 years, and most of my books have been published by small presses, and that's excellent. I mean, there are excellent small presses, and I had sort of, become accustomed to the fact that, well, that's where I am, and that's where I will continue to be. When suddenly Bloomsbury, through the good offices of my agent, Nat Sobel, read, in fact, Green Summer, and were extremely encouraging about it. I've had, in fact, that is the first novel that will be published. They're publishing, the two books that they're publishing are two of the books from my Copenhagen quartet, with different titles, which is a kind of a signal that that this is a new start. So In the Company of Angels is about the torture victim, the Chilean torture victim. And that will be published simultaneously in New York and in London. Then they will publish one other of the Copenhagen books. They haven't decided which of the other three yet, in 2011. But they sent out a press release last week in which they stated their intention to publish more or less all of my books and to reissue them to make them available to a much bigger audience.
Oh, that's going to make a big difference, yes.
That will make a great difference, but I'm sure that it has to do with how well the first two books do.
Yeah, that's usually the case.
Yes.
I don't think you're going to have any problems with that because your writing is very good. And what I think writers need is a very personal tone. And in other words, when you open up a book, somehow in the first chapter or whatever, you do get a sort of a personal tone. It's the same way in the music business. If you hear two notes of Elvis Presley, you know exactly who it is. And I think writers have that same...
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
That identity there, even though the stories are much different, you kind of know that person and look forward to their next book if you like them.
Well, thank you. And I'm just very happy to have this opportunity that Bloomsbury is giving me.
Yes.
And, you know, que sera, sera.
Exactly. Now, this collection of essays also that you have called Riding the Dog, which just came out fairly recently, it's a wonderful collection of essays about, of course, riding the dog would be the Greyhound bus all through different areas of the U.S., and the stories that came out of that, I think that's just such a great idea for a little a book of essays. And you do it so well. It's very, all the characters that you meet, you know, it's really well done.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. And how did you get the idea for that book?
I think it was in the back of my mind for some years. I have written quite a bit on the Greyhound bus. And then I was thinking about the fact, I was thinking about taking like 3 months out of my life and just riding around the United States on a Greyhound bus and just writing about it and taking notes and such. Mm. But, you know, 3 months is a long time to spend on a Greyhound bus. So what I did was I took a couple of individual trips, and I took also some Amtrak trips, and found that I got enough material out of two or three trips to sort of write a couple of essays, and then I started writing about different. You know, the subtitle of the book is the title is "Riding the Dog: A Look Back at America," and so every time I came back after spending, you know, two or three decades in the United States, I would be very attentive to what was going on around me and the people that I met and the things that I saw, and took a lot of notes. And so then I started writing essays about different experiences. For example, I was in New York City during the East Coast, the Great East Coast Blackout of 2003, and I wrote an essay about that called "In the Dark." Then I revisited my hometown in Queens, New York. You know, there are five boroughs in New York, and Queens is one of them. And I revisited my hometown and found it utterly changed. And so I wrote an essay about that. Then I, on one occasion, I took a kind of a pub crawl through lower Manhattan, where I visited all of the bars, the different bars that that different writers had hung around in, and also visited the places that, where they had lived, and tried to get a sense of how those places were now. And so that's another essay in the book. That's called Land Where My Fathers Wrote.
So this book, this is a wonderful little book because it's really all sort of like short stories about this trip. And you sort of get to discover America maybe from underneath the normal view of most Americans. And for that reason, it's quite real. The dialogue and the stories are quite interesting and sometimes off the wall, but always very interesting. I noticed that you say that you're going to be, or that you're working on a memoir entitled Chasing Jack, all about Jack Kerouac.
Well, it's not so much about Jack Kerouac as about myself as a young man when I wanted to sort of be like Jack Kerouac, where I was sort of trying to find him. And throughout the 60s, most of the 60s, I was hitchhiking around the United States and also riding buses and riding bicycles and things all around the country. And then I suddenly got the idea that, you know, maybe this would be a good, you know, starting point for a memoir. And so I've got that nearly finished now. And it was interesting because when I looked back on my life in the 60s, it seemed to me that I had just wasted my time. You know, I dropped out of college. I went into the Army. I got out of the Army. And then I couldn't settle down. So I was just kind of traveling around and not doing much of anything, sort of trying to write. But I mean, I was not really seriously applying myself. And it seemed to me that I was having a miserable time. But when I revisited it to write about it, I suddenly thought, wow, you know, that was kind of fun there, that thing that happened there in Fort Worth, Texas. And those months in Ocean Beach in San Diego, they were really fun. And, you know, suddenly I rediscovered my youth and saw it through a completely different lens. And so that was a real pleasure for me. I sort of came to understand a little bit more about that time in my life. When you're young, you're, well, not all people, not all young people, but many young people are kind of lost. It's a painful experience going through youth, I think. There's so much uncertainty and you don't know whether you're going to find a decent job, whether you're going to find a mate, whether you're going to have a family, whether, you know, and so on and so forth. So it's there's a lot of uncertainty. But, you know, at the same time, there's a freedom that that you don't really experience as a mature adult.
We used to have a rule in our house that, Sunday was kept very low key and so on and so forth. And I wanted to watch the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And who didn't? But
this is let me guess, February 1963.
Yeah, I think you've probably got it. Yeah. And I, you know, I told my mother, I said, this is really important. I have to see this. I'll be really good and whatever. So I did. And finally I saw them and I said to myself, I can do that. I looked at all those screaming girls. I said, that's it. That's my job. And, you know, within a very few months, I had formed a little band with guys down the street, and it ended up that I was in the music business quite seriously for over 20 years.
Wow.
Eventually playing piano bars and so on like that. I still have my keyboard, right? But that got me through. You know, if you do get hitched up to an art form, especially, but any job really, it can carry you through just by the sheer joy of it, many, many hard times, because you have that abiding feeling that you know where your joy is, you know?
Absolutely. Actually, I had a songwriting period in the 60s as well.
I noticed that in your bio, yeah.
Yeah, where I hooked up with a rock group called Hammer. And I really, really loved that because, you know, when you're writing fiction, you're working alone. It's a very lonely work. You know, once you find your way yes. into the story that you're writing, then you're not lonely anymore. But trying to get into that story is a lonely job. Whereas writing, I was writing song lyrics with a very talented guitarist.
Yeah.
And this was just pure fun for me. You know, we would sit up and we would drink beer and smoke cigarettes and smoke other things. And he would play his guitar and I would, you know, give him words for his lines, give him lyrics. And never took it very seriously or never took it seriously at all. Until suddenly, he actually got some very good, some powerful connections, and suddenly I had a songwriting contract with what's his name, the fellow who ran the Fillmore East and the Fillmore West,
Bill Graham.
Bill Graham, yeah, and they this group which was called Hammer.
Yeah,
they cut their first album on San Francisco Records, which was a subsidiary of Atlantic, and they went on a tour where they opened for, you know, Jimi Hendrix and Miles Davis and you name them, and it was looking very promising, and I made more money at that than I'd ever made at anything in my life. But their record flopped. It was a critical success, but it was not a commercial success. And the band just sort of disbanded. And I went on my way because, you know, I didn't realize that, you know, rock music is just as serious as any other art form. For me, it was just a lark. But it was a nice lark. I enjoyed it.
Well, just in talking about writing in general and your writing in general, what is it that drives you or moves you, and how do you catch an idea, or how does that work? How does the process work for you that some idea somehow catches you and you pull that idea and like reeling in a fish? Is there a technique that you use for that, or is it more spontaneous, or how does that work there, Thomas?
Well, I guess what drives my fiction is... I don't know what's going to happen in a book when I start out writing it. I work very intuitively, and to me, the creation of a book is a process of discovery. So, you know, some people plan out a writing project. I don't do that. What I do is I start with a kind of a feeling, maybe a piece of language. A book might, or a story might, start with an expression on someone's face, or, you know, some strange piece of language, and which sort of captures my imagination. And I'll go with that, or I'll try to go with that and follow it and try to discover what was it that fascinated me about that thing. And so, I mean, I have to keep it intuitive. I don't know what's going to happen until it happens. And if I know how a book is going to end, usually that book does not get written, because then I lose interest in it. What keeps me going is the same kind of suspense that keeps a reader going, I think. You know, what's going to happen?
Yeah, I can certainly understand that. I was wondering if you'd be kind enough to maybe do a little bit of reading for our listeners here, if you would mind.
I'd be pleased to.
Yes, that would be really great, just to listen to I like to get authors to read if they can or are willing to, because it really, listening to a writer reading his own stuff really seems to bring it right off the page.
Well, maybe I'll read, for example, I'll start by reading the first page of the title essay of Riding the Dog, if that's okay.
Okay. Beautiful.
The young man carries his possessions in a brown paper bag and a shoebox. I notice him when I board the coach at Greenville. His name is Marvin, and he wears a pale blue shirt and baggy yellow pants, no jacket despite the nippy January afternoon. He tells a friendly brown-faced woman in the seat across the aisle from him that he has been traveling for over 30 hours since Detroit, and that he is 23 years old and has been in prison since he was 16. I wonder what he was in for. Drugs, probably. Packed away during the 90s when tough laws cleaned the streets of rubbish so the increasingly wealthy folk felt free to go out and spend their fortunes. Now the prisons, like most everyone else, are going broke and slipping loose the nonviolence as an economy measure. An hour south, at a brief stop outside Greenwood, the clan of smokers gather around a redwood table and light up. The friendly brown-faced woman from the bus sits on the bench near where I stand. She tells me she's been on since Detroit, too, and we chat about means of transport and smoker facilities, the little smoky gas chamber I encountered a while back on the Amtrak from New York to Chicago. Oh, here. Sorry, I lost my place. The young man named Marvin comes sideways between us, folded stiffly forward like a half-opened jackknife, palms joined. "I truly do not wish to be a trouble, ma'am," he says softly to the brown woman, "but I am very unsure where I got to change the bus and what I got to do. I find myself confused." "You going to Beaufort, right?" she asks. "We take care of you." "Yes, ma'am, I got two children there, two girls. I just love them to death." If he's been in jail since he was 16, he must have started a family about as soon as he was able. Nuptial visitation rights, maybe. "I'm going to Beaufort, too," I tell him. "We change in Savannah in about 2 hours and have about an hour's wait. I'll show you where we have to get the bus." But the young man looks pointedly away from me. It occurs to me I have no real idea what he was in for or what horrors he might have experienced of 7 years in prison, to what extent the contemporary mythology of American prisons is grounded in fact, or for that matter, such being the prejudices engendered by suspicion, what kind of metal he might be carrying in pocket, shoe, or body cavity. "I'll let you know when we have to change," I say again, attempting to clarify whether he simply hadn't realized I was addressing him. But he continues pointedly to ignore me, in my necktie and Stetson hat. The brown woman pats the boy's hand and repeats, "We take care of you. We see you come no harm." It occurs to me she is a natural leader, a person who inspires confidence, who exudes the qualities of true leadership and consideration for justice and the rights of all. It seems to me it would be wonderful to be her, strong and clear of nature. I wish that I could talk more with her, learn more about her life. She seems to me the salt of the earth, but I will only be allowed this small glimpse during a smoke stop. "This is the correct bus for Beaufort," asks Marvin once again. And I remember how confused I was at 23, how I bounced all over the country during the 60s.
Yeah, it really paints, you've got the little bit of the vernacular in there, which I love to hear in a story, because it really tends to take you right there in the dialogue.
Well, I love that about riding on the Greyhound bus, too. And I love that about North America, actually, because you hear so many different ways of speaking English.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved that when I was growing up in New York, too. You know, I lived in a neighborhood with Irish, German, English, South American, Greeks, Italians, and everyone spoke English in his or her own way, and It was wonderful to hear. I loved it. I loved it.
You'll have to come to Toronto, because here you'll find a whole new styles of English you'd never hear anywhere else.
I'm sure. I've heard that you have the largest Greek colony outside of Greece in the world.
Oh, yes. And what is interesting, you see, in Canada here, our population is not high in relative to terms of like the United States or almost any other country in Europe, and certainly not China. But most immigrants come to Toronto or Montreal or Vancouver, usually Toronto, but we take more than half. So every year we get maybe 100,000 or 150,000 new people from all over the world. And it's just incredible. And of course, that makes all the different stores interesting too, because you have restaurants from their kind of food that they bring with them from their old country. So makes Toronto a very interesting city that way. So
it sounds it. I was there once many years ago, and I really liked it, but I was only there for a very, very brief visit.
Well, if you ever get here, call me up, because we'll take a little trip around. And we do have something, a rare thing that you would know about here. We have serving houses.
Okay. serving houses are good.
We don't call them serving houses, but I know in you do in your town. So,
hey, a rose by any other name.
did you want to read a little bit more, or?
Sure. Shall I read from another essay?
That would be great. Yeah, it's great.
Well, this is from the essay In the Dark, which is about the blackout. This is also from the book Riding the Dog.
Yes.
And this
yes.
particular essay is about the blackout, the electrical failure on the East Coast in the summer of 2003.
Yep.
And at the time, I was in Queens visiting my sister, but my hotel was in Manhattan. And as soon as the lights went off and the stereo went off and the refrigerator went off, I knew what was happening, because I had lived through a blackout before. And I knew that it was important for me to get back to Manhattan as soon as I could, because I would not be able to get a taxi. I would have to hitchhike and so forth. So I went right out on the road and I hitchhiked. And New Yorkers are great in a crisis. You know, people picked me up, and then I made my way to the Queensboro Bridge, and I walked across the Queensboro Bridge over the East River, and I got back into Manhattan, and that's where I'll be reading from, just a couple of pages.
Sure, thanks. Yeah.
Soon I am off the Queensboro Bridge, heading west across Manhattan. The only light on the streets is from the headlights of automobiles and buses. The windows of the tall buildings are dark, the streetlights dead. For a moment, the prospect of crossing the avenue seems terrifying, but I plunge out into the road and the cars and trucks and buses stop. There are no angry faces. Everyone understands. New Yorkers thrive in crisis. It is eerie in the streets. Shadowy figures everywhere, huddled against walls, in doorways, alone, in clusters. Here and there, a group of policemen and policewomen stand chatting, hips fat with guns and clubs and handcuffs and citation pads. Alone against one tall wall leans a black policewoman, a head shorter than myself, which is pretty short. Staring noncommittally into my eyes, she is at once thick and shapely, and her Fellini-like sensuality arrests me. I move on, feeling I have abandoned a portal to some weird dimension. In a doorway off Second Avenue, a young woman huddles with a dark-skinned, fine-featured 3-year-old girl who looks like a Cosby Show stand-in. The woman is Hispanic, in her early 20s, pretty, her fright evident beneath the impassivity of her face. I stop and look into the doorway. Can I help you, I ask? I carried her all the way down from 135th Street, the woman says. She thirsty. Her eyes search my face. Someone grabbed my butt in the dark. It occurs to me that we are only 3 or 4 blocks east of the Plaza Hotel. For some reason, the plaza seems a haven of civilization. Surely the plaza is where to go with this young mother and her thirsty baby. I picture the three of us at a candle-lit table in the oak bar, the woman and her baby with Cokes, cool water, a lemonade perhaps, a melting dish of ice cream, me with a magnificent oak bar martini shaken expertly by Orlando Rivera, who has served me many times before. We could share an oak bar shrimp cocktail, shrimp the size of small lobster with spicy red horseradish sauce. What better place to bring Chanel and little Kyla? I offer to carry the baby. Without hesitation, she climbs into my arms, leans her marzipan face against my chest. I've been in the Air Force, Chanel tells me. Kyla's dad was in there, too. Where is he now, I ask. Gone, she says, like my own dad. Where do you live? 23rd Street. Her eyes sweep toward me, nervous with apology. We in a shelter for a while. At Grand Army Plaza, men and women sit around the edges of the fountain and on the stone benches. The rank of handsome cabs stands at the ready, as always, wrapped in the heady smell of horse, and people mill about outside the plaza's darkened entry. On the steps to the lobby, ranged across the center, stand a white woman and a hotel-uniformed black man wearing name tags. The woman's smile has an unmistakable edge of strained public relations. "What is your room number, please, sir?" she asks as we start up the steps. "I don't have a room," I say, "but this young woman and her baby are very thirsty. I'd just like to buy them something cool to drink." "I'm sorry, sir." The uniformed man is tall and broad above us on the steps. He watches me. His name tag says Washington. "You're not really going to turn us away," I say. "This baby is thirsty." "I'm sorry, sir." She smiles when she says it. Washington does not smile. Across Fifth Avenue, just over from the Sherry Netherlands Hotel, we sit on a low stone wall, and I buy bottles of water at uninflated prices from a Sabretz hot dog wagon. The water is still cool. What a cliché the contrast of the Sabretz man's friendly brown-faced smile seems here in the dark, crowded, hot street, across from the greatest hotel in the world that would not even give this little girl a lousy glass of water. I'll stop there.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Thomas, for reading from Riding the Dog, which is his latest publication out in the United States and North America. And is that also the case in Europe?
Well, it's published by New American Press, which is a small publishing house in Colorado.
Okay.
But the book is available on Amazon.
You know, it's been a real pleasure to connect with you again and talk about your work and also your new contracts that you've signed for with Bloomsbury. That's very exciting. I'm very happy for you.
Well, thank you very much.
It really does give you the recognition that a press like that gives you after all this hard work with smaller presses, which is great, like you say. But to be with somebody, I think Bloomsbury was the publisher of Harry Potter, weren't they?
Quite. And I'm hoping that they will put the same kind of promotion effort into my books that they put into Harry Potter.
I think you're in good hands there. I think you're in good hands.
I've been really encouraged. Now, I've spoken with my editor in New York, and I've spoken with I have two editors in London.
Yes.
And they are simply so positive and so encouraging. You know, I sort of expected to come into the the big world, so to speak, with my hat in my hand. But that is not at all the way they have been treating me. They have been treating me very, very well.
That is really fantastic. And your website is simply thomasekennedy.com.
That's right. It's all in one. www.thomasekennedyallinone.com.
Yeah. And it's a very excellent website. It has all different kinds of all the kinds of work that Thomas has done, and I think one of the reasons why he's becoming so successful is that he has really gotten into an awful lot of different kinds of work. You've written plays, like you say, you were in the songwriting field for a while. All this come together really gives you so many experiences to draw on, and that's maybe why you're finally really, people are seeing your really true talent there, Thomas.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Jake.
You're more than welcome, and I'm happy to have you back on Authors Audio.
Well, I'm afraid we have come to the end of our time with Thomas E. Kennedy, one of America's great writers, actually. He has 26 books out there, and his latest book is called Riding the Dog. And I'd like you to have a look into his very large oeuvre of material, and I think you may become a Thomas E. Kennedy fan like I am, for sure. You can go to his website at thomasekennedy.com, and it is quite an extensive website, so you won't have any trouble finding his work there, and comments, and interviews, and so on and so forth. So, with that, this is Jake D. Steele from Authors Audio saying, until next time, keep dreaming and happy reading, and bye for now.